business teams, and his team, he'll introduce them in a moment. I should start with some news about one of our members. Brandon Topham is not well. He had to go to hospital, and I gathered this yesterday, and I phoned him to convey our very good wishes to him. He is recovering well. In fact, I gathered from him that he cannot fly, so he can't come to the meetings, presumably, probably until early next year. Well, at least he's unlikely, I think, to be here by the end of the quarter sittings next Wednesday. So he won't be here, I think. But I did on your behalf convey our very good wishes for him. He looks in good spirits, and he'll be fine, I sense, and I have no doubt. But let me move on also to say, Tandi is here. She's got a slight calf problem, and so she'll be slightly late. Pule was at the INSEE meeting till after 10 p.m., he tells me, and he's on his way here and will be here shortly, probably late into the morning. For the rest of the members, I don't know where they are, but I hear that they took part in the, shopping they call it? What? Black Friday shopping, and they haven't been seen since. I've also been told that, typical of us MPs, they turned up there at 20 past 8 in the morning, and they told the people who gathered there from 1:15 in the morning, hey, do you know who we are? We are members of Parliament. And they tried to get to the front of the queue, and that's the last time they were seen. So, and there's no Hamburg Ashley M. Konto for that situation from the ACP. So, and over to Judge Dennis Davis. I'm very pleased to have you to also explain very quickly. We wanted you here before, and in fact, you were stolen, so to speak, by the Trade and Industry Committee. And so, whatever you fed into that committee on basically in particular, was referred to us. What's the point of calling you again on that very matter? But we are very interested to hear from you because it's a big theme. In fact, we're planning to have, I've been speaking to international relations, just to let you know, but we will know in the first, to have a major conference in South Africa on it, at least a BRICS conference maybe, but broader, because we think it's a big issue. So amongst the other issues, I know you're going to speak on that today in consultation with the members, we suggested that that be one of the issues. So over to you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I do recall that being here as well, and I can't remember whether that was before or after the Trade and Industry Subcommittee, but we have had one meeting at some point, I think, this committee.
Yes,
I recall very clearly because you still asked me about the book I wrote with Robert Fine at a committee meeting.
Ah, yes, that's right, yeah. But this is a proper continuation.
Anyway, thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you very much for having us. Let me introduce my colleagues from my right, not necessarily in political terms, but just geographic. Professor Thabo Legwana, Professor Netaguta, who are both committee members, and Mr. Vinesh Pillay, who has really kept our whole operation and our secretariat going for a very long time, and we're very, very grateful to him. Are you going to press these buttons? Okay. So we've got, that's our sort of menu. Was just to briefly recap our mandate, our terms of reference, and then move through, as you can see.
The tea and coffee have come. If people want to have perhaps you also want to.
Somebody gave me one, but I mean everybody else.
So do you want to have a 3-minute break? Just go and get it, or shall we continue? What do you want? A small break. Okay, fine. Sorry about that. But can we get going? So 3 minutes and then we'll stop. Right, thank you.
Hello, yeah.
Thank you very much. I think there's one more member to come. Okay, shall we get started? Judge is about 45 minutes to an hour enough. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. So let me then start by saying the key areas that we were going to look at were the reports that we already handed in, and you can see those up there. But let me just turn briefly we were appointed in 2013, and perhaps I should prefigure something, Mr. Chair, which is, I'm not sure we can, but I'm quite determined, if we possibly can, to complete our work by the end of next year. One of the difficulties we've had, which will become apparent, is we've been getting more and more requests for all sorts of things as we carry on. The mandate of our committee, as you can see, there was very broad, and the emphasis to inquire into the role of the tax system, the promotion of inclusive economic growth, employment creation, development and fiscal sustainability. I should just say that the way we work is we prepare reports which go to the minister, and the minister has to grant approval for publication. So often I get requests like, where's that report? Why hasn't it been published? The answer is, got to go to the minister, and the minister then okays the publication that comes out. And we'll come back to that. Very briefly, you can see from the statistics which you have that we've had 179 submissions on a variety of topics. We've had all sorts of meetings, 176 meetings we held with all sorts of people on a range of topics, and I'll get back to that. We encourage comments on our interim reports. There are interim reports which are out now, which we're hoping to get more comments on, and I will emphasize that in due course, if I may. You'll also notice on the next page, we've made a huge play for getting support from international organizations, the World Bank and the IMF in particular, and I should explain why. It's because they've got technical competence that we don't have in this country. They can run models, which we just simply aren't able to do in South Africa. So we've really, if you look at what we've done, we're looking, and we continue to look at, the question of the effective tax burden in South Africa and the effectiveness of investment incentives. Now, you can't just do that on the back of a cigarette box. You've got to actually look at precisely if you've got a 28% corporate rate of tax, or what is the effective tax and how is that affecting investment, so and so forth. We've had a really detailed study of the value-added tax gap. And what that means, and I should just mention that, is we've tested whether our value-added tax, what you'd expect to get from a 14% tax rate, and what you do get, what's the difference? And I was hoping it would be rather large, because then it would be very easy for me to say, here's how we can find another 100 billion. The answer is, it's astoundingly efficient. It's one of the most efficient, if not the most efficient, VAT systems in the world. And it is so because of the fact that we have a narrow band of zero ratings and a narrow band of exemptions and one rate. But it's the first time that that's ever been done in South Africa, and it was invaluable. And in relation to the mining and petroleum reports, it was perfectly clear that given the paucity of expertise in South Africa, and I should also add the skewed nature of the expertise, because the mining houses have expertise, but that doesn't mean anybody else has. So you need to get reports from people who are going to take a somewhat more a helicopter vision of the system. And to be honest, the reports that we got from the IMF, these are people who have done a huge amount of work all over the show. And I should also say that in these reports, we've been incredibly aided by people from SARS who really are very good. And that's how we've managed to generate where we have. So here is our progress. We have produced two reports on small and medium enterprises. I shall come back to that in a moment. We have two reports on base erosion and profit shifting, and I'm going to ask my colleague, Professor Guto, who has been responsible for that. I should just add in parenthesis, the way we've operated is in our topics is to ask a member of the committee to chair it and then generate the work accordingly with other people. We've had two reports on macro analysis, and I would recommend that's on our website. It's a lengthy report, but it's a report that has been peer-reviewed by all sorts of people, not just by the World Bank, but a whole range of economists, both internally and externally, and gives a really, I think, careful map of the sort of tax system that South Africa should be looking towards over the next number of years in the light of the mandate that we had, which is how do you have a tax system that's efficient, legitimate, promotes job creation, promotes investment, and promotes the inclusive growth within the economy. We've had one VAT report. We've also had work done by the IMF on that, as I've indicated. We're in the process of finalizing a second VAT report, which hopefully will be in relatively shortly. Unfortunately, our principal researcher here, Des Kruger, has been ill, and that's retarded us to some extent. We have produced a report on two reports on estate duty, which has CGT implications, and I'll get back to that too. As I indicated, we've had three reports on mining. We've advised the Minister on Border Management Agency Bill and also on tertiary education. And perhaps just, let me say something about that. I'm not quite sure that we did say much more about that, but I just want to say something about that, if I may, up front, those last two. We were asked by both the Minister and indeed the Commissioner, who spoke with me at some length about this, about the issue of customs and excise and income tax. And I should say, and I'm happy to debate this with people, I know it's a hot issue, is that we were very clear that there should be no change, that there's 300 billion rand at stake here, because if you work out the customs, the VAT, and all the rest of it, that's what we're talking about. So it's a very significant sum of money. And if you monkey around with that system, and I'm not suggesting for one moment that if it goes to another department, that will be done inefficiently, but I would not be taking the risk. And I was rereading the Katz Commission's report, which in a sense recommended the consolidation of the customs and excise and revenue back in the day, which gave rise to the SARS Act of 1997 and consolidated the two entities. I think it's terribly, terribly important that we ensure that which is working should not be changed. And so we're strongly of the view that, in fact, SARS should continue to run the customs. On the question of tertiary education, we thought that it was appropriate that we should say something. We thought that it was appropriate that we should make some tentative recommendations to the Minister. After all, if there is going to be a further funding of tertiary education, the money's got to come from somewhere. And who better than actually being able to at least to have a somewhat broader view of the tax system than the people actually investigating the tax system. I would like to say in all humility that I think we came up with some rather more concrete recommendations in the interim report of the Hare Commission, although frankly that's not particularly difficult. The point I'm simply making is we in brief on this point, and I can move on because I'm sure people might want to talk about it, we came to the view it was impossible on the present system state of economy and our present tax system to actually say that we could fund tertiary education on a free basis for every single person in South Africa at present. We also weren't convinced that that was progressive. To be blunt, I didn't see any reason why somebody like myself should not pay for my children to go to university, particularly in a country with the kind of Gini coefficient that we have. We did think that there was clearly an imperative to ensure that far more people who were worthy to go to universities and to tertiary institutions and who clearly were under pressure, way more than a figure of 120,000 rand per year, which their parents might earn, that they should in fact be funded. And we made a series of, I think, concrete recommendations as how to fund an increased group to ensure perhaps a vindication of our constitutional obligations under Section 29. And I'd be more than happy to talk about that. So we try to steer a path between, on the one hand, saying the present status quo is not satisfactory. On the other hand, it is naive and, I think, somewhat irresponsible for people to claim that it's easy to find the 60-odd billion which would be required for full tertiary education at this stage, given the finances in this country, and I should add the competing claims for things like pre-primary education, healthcare, just to name two. So that was why we did that. And I think that, if I can just make one other point on that, Mr. Chair, before moving on, that exactly reveals something which has put us in a different context to the Katz Commission in which I served during the 1990s, is that given both the state of the economy and, as it were, the demands, which clearly are more acute now in a political sense than they were in the 90s, we are being called upon to do things which take us out of our core work into other areas, but we think that's important for the national debate and the national interest, and I'm very happy to explain. In relation to subcommittees in operation now, as I indicated, we have to complete our VAT report, and we shall do so hopefully by early next year. We're at the moment, as I understand it, Vinesh, correct, we're going to try to approve our Hard Rock report tomorrow at a full committee meeting, and an oil and that hopefully, once that's out, then the minister will give permission, and you can all then read what our recommendations are on that. And that follows an earlier report and a whole range of feedback that we've had on oil and gas. We're moving along there, and we obviously are close to getting into a more final state in that regard. Public benefit organisations, we have a committee dealing with that, and briefly put, what we're testing is whether in fact the tax dispensation for what used to in the old days be called charitable, ecclesiastical and educational institutions, whether in fact those, our tax dispensation, both in the relation to the exemption from income tax for these institutions and the deduction thereof, is satisfactory under the present system. And it raises a whole round of quite profound questions. Hopefully, if we can get some further feedback from some of the members' subcommittee, that is, we'll be able to close out on that fairly shortly. Tax administration is a massive topic for all sorts of reasons. Some obvious and some perhaps less obvious, but where we are on that, if I can just indicate, and I'll come back to that, is we've got a committee, my colleague Professor Ligwala and myself and Deborah Tickle are involved in that. It's come late in the day, and I'll come back to it, but we've already got sort of tentative drafts on various aspects, and I'll fill you in on that later. We've got a serious subcommittee operating under related to funding of government programs, and in particular the National Health Insurance Scheme, in which we've been trying to work with the Department of Health and others in relation to how we fund that. Critically is the issue of tax incentives and whether they're efficient, whether they promote our economic objectives, whether they're a waste of money. These are really important issues. And finally, corporate income tax, and I'll come back to that. We still have to look at wealth taxes, and we still have a report to do on the taxation of trusts, which is separate from the estate duty report. That is trusts in relation to income tax, and I'll emphasize that presently in our report. Let me briefly then turn to small and medium-sized businesses, in which we've produced two reports. And that was based on 37 submissions, 16 sets of comments, a string of meetings. The answer is that small and medium-sized business is not promoted by the tax system in the main. And it's naive to believe that simply fiddling around with the tax system is going to propel small and medium-sized businesses into the center of our economy. That is not, however, to suggest that, in fact, there aren't issues that can be dealt with. We do think, and I'm going to be brief on this, that the system, by and large, is not inadequate. We've met with the Minister of Small Business Development, and we're happy to meet with them again, Minister Zudu, in relation to this particular issue. What we have suggested, and if you'll see this on the third of the slides, is the Minister accepted recommendations to retain the turnover tax system for micro businesses, that's turnover up to R1 million, to simplify it, more generous tax rates. We hold the view that the generous tax and depreciation rates for small business corporations, that's a turnover up to R20 million, costs R1.36 billion per year. It doesn't reach the majority SBCs. And the reason is that when we tested that, and we thought, who gets the money? Then you start seeing estate agents and a very variety of professional bodies which are getting the... And that's not where employment creation comes from. With the greatest respect to estate agents, they aren't the group that is going to actually generate, you know, huge levels of employment. And so what we were saying, and we came in for a lot of flack on this, but we convinced about this, we drilled down and we looked at the figures. The answer is that the generous dispensation in relation to SPCs does not seem, in the main, to go to corporations which, to a large extent, seems to me, are the ones which are going to generate the employment which we desperately need in this country. And it was for that reason that what we thought was, let's not waste that money. Let's give everybody some form of rebate to ensure that, in a sense, compliance with tax law, with tax regulation, can, in a sense, be as free as possible for this group, because you bring them into the system, and as they grow, you then generate more tax. What we were trying to do was, what is the optimum basis by which we could use the $1.36 billion? We're also of the view that the skills development levy has some significant problems for small businesses, and here there is a serious recommendation which needs consideration. As I understand it, once your wage bill gets up above 500,000 rands, then you have to pay this levy. And the difficulty with the levy is that the levy is supposed to then be rebated back to you in order to promote training of your staff. But the compliance burden on small businesses is so onerous that they never seem to be able to claim the levy back. And so they're paying it out as a tax and not getting the benefits for training of staff. And we need to actually find a way to ensure that they can claim back their share of that levy when they are promoting the training of staff. That's the objective of the exercise, and that is why we made that particular recommendation on that front. So that's so much a small business. I'm going to turn over the presentation on the base erosion and profit shifting to Professor Aguto. I should say that those of you who've crawled through our website where we've got this will see hundreds and hundreds of pages of detailed recommendations, and that's frankly due to Professor Aguto and her team, for which I'm hugely indebted. But she's in a much better position to take you through that than I am. So over to you.
Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to be here. Well, I'll just give you a brief overview of what we brought about, or what our recommendations are regarding base performance of African perspective. So basically, base erosion and profit shifting, as those of us that have been following the details regarding it, came to the forefront after the global financial crisis, basically regarding concerns about taxpayers and mainly multinational enterprises that manipulate the gaps in the interaction of different countries' tax systems so that they can reduce the amount of taxable income that they pay in the countries that they transact in, which results in them shifting profits to low tax jurisdictions, and often there is little or no economic activity that is taking place there. BEPS has a reason because of the fact that domestic and international tax laws that have been developed for decades and decades have not kept pace with the economic environment and modern business models that we now have in place. And now there is a lower degree of economic integration that is happening across borders, and that is how multinationals or taxpayers in general have been able to manipulate these laws in order to get low taxes, or to pay, not to pay their fair share of taxes in the jurisdictions that they transact in. BEPS is quite very technical, as Dennis has explained. It's quite elaborate, But the issue we are dealing with here is that it's the corporate income tax system that is at stake. So to address BEPS issues, the OECD came up with a package of measures, and the final measures were released in 2015, and the purpose is to ensure that the profits that are taxed by the profits of these multinational organizations are taxed where the economic activities generating those profits are actually performed and where value is created. So there's a whole list of 15 action plans, and the essence behind all of this is that the measures that the OECD recommends are designed to be implemented domestically and also through tax treaty provisions that are supposed to be coordinated, and they are intended to ensure that there is stronger monitoring and strengthening of transparency so as to align the taxation of taxable profits where the location of economic activity actually takes place and where value is created. So essentially the information that will be got out of the measures that will come out of coming up with these provisions will ensure that tax authorities are able to apply their tax laws effectively. What happens is that the OECD work on BEPS actually brought together about 44 countries on an equal footing, and these were mainly OECD member countries and OECD BEPS associate countries, including the G20 countries, of which South Africa is a part, which worked together and came up with a consensus on how to resolve issues pertaining to BEPS. Since South Africa is one of the G20 countries, it was one of the countries that worked together or participated in the working parties of the OECD that shaped the outcomes of the OECD BEPS project. Now, the work of the Davis Tax Committee, despite the fact that South Africa as a country participated in the BEPS work at the OECD level, the work of the Davis Tax Committee was to address BEPS from a South African perspective. What are the recommendations that we have to offer in order to deal with BEPS from a South African perspective? Now, we need to acknowledge that although there is abundant circumstantial evidence that BEPS behaviors happen worldwide, there is no solid conclusion about how much BEPS actually occurs internationally. Countries like the UK try to come up with a report to determine or measure the tax gap that they actually the tax gap in the UK. And I think in our microeconomic report, we are trying to come up with something that we try to determine how much of taxes that we are actually losing. And there have also been several studies and data that indicate that there is increasing segregation between the location of actual business activities and where profits are reported for tax purposes. But the issue here that although the question of how much revenue is lost is highly interesting for the public, there's been a lot of concern and public outcry about taxes that are being lost. The studies that are currently in place, there are various methodological flows regarding the estimates that some of these studies have come up with in order to determine exactly how much revenue has been lost. So there aren't very accurate estimates of how much profits are actually lost in the country. And some of the famous reports that countries have, some institutions and especially non-government organizations have attempted to come up with figures that indicate BEPS, the BEPS, especially from developing country perspective and how much revenue is being lost. But usually they come up with a proxy about what BEPS estimates are and what illicit financial flows, equating that with illicit financial flows and BEPS. For example, we have reports by the Tax Justice Network. If you've read the report regarding the missing billions that estimates about 12 billion of corporate income tax that is lost each year, especially in developing countries, and specific emphasis also placed on what is lost in the UK. There have been reports by the Global Financial Integrity. There have been reports by that have major, especially on South Africa, stating that the country has lost billions in tax revenues, especially in the last decade, regarding how much that corporations are taking out of the country, including wealthy individuals. There is a report that was issued in 2012 that states that about 2.1 billion actually left the country under the radar. But the issue here is that there is a distinction between BEPS and illicit financial flows. BEPS refers to multinational organizations basically taking advantage of the weaknesses in the legal system itself or in the tax laws themselves and trying to ensure that they shift profits out of the country using apparently legal methods. But illicit financial flows, which are essentially, so to speak, not recorded, are essentially criminal activities involving, for example, tax evasion, involving various efforts that are used to take taxes out of the country or income out of the country. So the difference here is with the legality and the illegality of the capital flight that gets out of the country. So we do make a distinction of that in the BEPS report. So in coming up with a report on BEPS from the South African perspective, the DTC consulted with various stakeholders on BEPS. We consulted with the OECD itself that drafted the report. We consulted with business representatives, trade unions, civil society, tax practitioners, SALT, National Treasury, the Reserve Bank, members of international bodies and academics. We had meetings with them and we received various submissions on different BEPS issues. We issued our first interim report, like Dennis said, back in 2014, covering the action plans that the OECD had worked on by then. And then we also released to the minister our report that is waiting his approval this year in September. So in drafting our report, we do recognize that it is important to take into perspective the matters that are really pertinent for South Africa, especially our national sovereignty. We do consider the constitutional perspectives, the National Development Plan. We do consider the importance of protecting the tax base and protecting the competitiveness of the economy, the importance of adhering to a good tax system, good administration in order to protect the tax base, and the importance of exchange controls that have been a strong tax, door to protecting the country from outflow of capital from the country. And of course, we do look at the legislation that we had in place that helped to prevent base erosion even before the OECD came up with this report. And we did take into consideration the fact that it's important for us not to come up with unilateral recommendations that are not taking into consideration what is happening internationally that may result in double taxation. The DTC was of the view that before providing recommendation on BEPS in general, clarity had to first be provided on what South Africa's international tax policy should be. So all the recommendations that we came up with were basically not from a reactionary approach about what is happening globally, but we had to look or take cognizance of the special circumstances that the South Africa as a country is facing, considering that our country portrays aspects of both a developed and a developing country, and that it's an emerging economy on the African countries, on the African continent. We had to consider its administrative capacity, our trade partners, and especially our social geopolitical circumstances. So the conceptual framework, like I said, had to take into perspective things that are pertinent to our country, like the National Development Bank, and the need to balance the protection of the tax base with the competitiveness of the economy. We did recognize that the 15-point action plans that are quite detailed and technical deal with different dimensions of international tax planning by multinationals, which could affect countries in different ways depending on whether they are capital importing or capital exporting countries. So South Africa falls in both positions. So there are some action items that are relevant to us from the perspective of being a capital importing country and from the perspective of being a capital exporting country. We have so many homegrown multinationals that are investing abroad, and we have multinationals that are coming from out that actually do have a base here. So you find that most of the action plans have got an implication on South Africa. And so because we depend on, because of the range of issues that we have to deal with, being a country that portrays both aspects of developing and a developing country, for South Africa, there was a need for a balance in the way we approach the BEPS action plans. It was important for us to encourage the competitiveness of the economy, and at the same time to ensure that there is no base erosion that is taking place, so as to ensure that the country's tax base is actually protected. So the detailed recommendations regarding each of the action plans, for those that are interested, can study them in the report. And we are glad to say that a number of recommendations that we came up with were actually taken on by National Treasury and SARS. We did, for example, come up with a recommendation regarding Section 6 Queen that did actually make headlines last year, which for us was a provision that was resulting into South Africa eroding its tax base. I won't go into the detail, but there is a slide there regarding it. And we recommended that the provision actually be withdrawn, and it was actually withdrawn in the 2015 Taxation Laws Amendment Act. Section 6 Queen was withdrawn with effect from 1st January 2016, and instead there is a tax rebate that is being provided for taxpayers. We also made recommendations regarding modifying our income tax return so that it provides proper indicators regarding how to curtail BEPS, and this was taken on. We also made recommendations regarding expanding and upskilling South Africa's transfer pricing unit, and I think measures are being taken in that regard. We made recommendations regarding the country-by-country reporting, and legislation regarding the same was also adopted in 2015, and we trust that more legislation regarding this will, regarding our work will be adopted going forward. It's quite a detailed report. I think for now that should do. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And, I think we need some I
anxiety for us. And frankly, we think the burden of creep is out for Treasury to deal with that property. I have to confess, I need to study more fully the modeling and the what we had suggested at the time was that because we actually get the objective or intent there to deal with the question of externality in that it might be better to introduce an issue in the tax of zero liability and then have a look at what the effects are. And frankly, I think it's time to do this. I don't think that remains our position. I'm happy to answer any questions on that. That's basically our when it comes to the state,
I have to say this has been for me one of the more fascinating exercises for a reason I'll come to in a moment. We had three options. We could scrap the stamp duty and rely on CGT. We could refine the system and we could implement a wealth tax. If I could deal with the third first, I know that we were asked by government, I think as a result of deliberations that had taken place in the ruling party and then moved into government, and that's fine with us, came through government, that we should look at a wealth tax. But that's something one has to start from scratch and work one's way through. The question, therefore, was, what do you do in the interim? And our view was that there is a very big distinction between capital gains tax and estate duty. Capital gains tax, members, is actually, in our view, a deferred income tax. What it effectively means is that you get a gain, you don't necessarily pay tax in the way you do every year on an annual basis, but when the gain actually actualizes, you pay tax thereof, and the economic evidence pretty much universally would recognize it as a form of income tax on the deferred basis. Estate duty at present is one of the, it's possible that you could argue some of the transferred taxes with properties is also a capital tax, but other than that, you've only got estate duty. And our view was that estate duty should, in fact, not just stay, but should be enhanced. We say that for a couple of reasons. Let me start off by saying estate duty is no silver bullet. It's not going to raise 60 billion or 40 billion or 30 billion, but it will raise some additional money, 2, 3, 4, 5 billion, more than it does at present. At present, there's no reason to pay any estate duty because the actors got more holes in Swiss cheese, and the result is it's easy to circumvent. And our view is that in a country with a Gini coefficient the way it is, and with unbelievable imbalances in wealth, there has to be some tax on the accumulation of wealth. There just has to be. It just seems to me wrong, in principle, profoundly wrong, from a legitimacy, a moral, and ethical point of view, not to have it. We then looked at this and said, we don't want to punish middle-class people. We don't want to punish those people who really pay a lot of tax in any event, and they don't have dividend flows and big capital gains and so on and so forth, and yet they pay a significant contribution. So what we thought was, look, let's start with the interspousal abatement. That's a system where, at present, if you bequeath everything to your wife or husband, as the case may be, the survivor, there's no estate duty paid on everything that's bequeathed. And this has created a huge amount of tax planning opportunities for people, as a result of which there really are erosions of the base. And so what we said was, all right, let's ensure that we increase the primary abatement to 15 million. We could have it more if you want. It doesn't really make much difference if it's 15 or 20. But the whole idea was that the surviving spouse would get X, let's call it 15. 15 would, in a context of South Africa, mean that a decent house, say for 5 million, would be totally free of any estate duty, and you'd still have 10 million free of any estate duty. If you put that at 6 or 7%, there's 600,000 or 700,000 rands a year that you're earning on that. That protects people who, in a sense, perhaps need protection. What has shocked me, Mr. Chair, is the amount. I have, at last count, 7 emails from people who are billionaires I suspect dollar billionaires, not rand billionaires, who objected strongly to this, who tell me, you know, that I'm undermining the entire system and how dare I do this. My attitude is, I'm sorry, you know, my concerns aren't you. Shame, if you get to these 20% or 25% of your dutiable value, you know, and you've only got, let's say, 75% of $3 billion, I'm sure you can make do. And so I really think, you know, it's about time people started to realize that in a country like ours, there are burdens that have to be shouldered if you're going to, in a sense, exercise citizenship in the proper way. We do suggest that the estate duty be increased from 20% to 25% for a dutiable estate exceeding 30 million. That's a lot of money for the vast majority of South Africans. I know people are going to say you've probably calibrated that as more than what a judge's estate would be. It's vastly more than mine, as can be shown from the fact that we now have to report our estates. So we then made a series of further recommendations with regard to donations tax, and we've also, if you have a look move on to the next one, Vinesh, the trusts. Because what we've done with trusts is, I want to stress this, our focus at the moment in relation to trusts has been insofar as estate duty is concerned. I'll come back to that in a moment, what I mean by that, but this is what I was suggesting, is that there is a section of the Estate Duty Act which we named 33D. What essentially happens with most estate plans is the following, that somebody sets up an estate plan, takes 100 and gives it as an interest-free loan to the trust. The trust then invests the 100. When the person dies, that may be worth a million, whatever it is, but all that forms part of their estate is the 100, which is the loan. And our argument is that if you continue to control the estate, the trust, then in fact that should be yours. Other countries have used different techniques to do the same thing called generation skipping devices. I can explain that. But the point was to attack trusts where they are crudely being used to shield money which, in a sense, should form part of the estate. I want to stress that this does not mean that we've actually fully dealt with the question I want to stress that in relation to income tax and trusts, as opposed to estate duty and trusts, our recommendations are not fully completed. And there's a reason for that. Because I'm waiting for SARS to give us figures that they've got on trusts in generally, so that they've got data which I need to look at to see precisely what is going on in the use of trust insofar as income tax is concerned. Let me make one other point, Mr. Chair. Clear about the estate duty attempt to attack trusts where they avoid estate duty. In relation to income tax, we do think as well that where trusts ultimately are being used to income split, we need to think about how we deal with that more aggressively. At the same time, we are cognizant, which is why it makes it slightly difficult, to look at the question of trusts in circumstances where certain trusts are perfectly legitimate to protect against insolvency, to ensure that, in fact, children don't just simply dispose of all the income or capital that may otherwise go to them in circumstances that are sensible. So we're in the process of significantly looking at the question of both local trusts and discretionary trusts. We set out a fairly detailed descriptions in the presentation, but I don't want to waste more time on that because, as I say, we're still in the process of finalizing those recommendations. What we are clear about is that the estate duty signs, 33D, and the question of donations tax to spouses and the question of the abatement, those should be implemented expeditiously. We believe there would be more money there for the fiscus. It may only be a couple billion more, but that's not unimportant. Insofar as wealth tax is concerned, this is a tricky issue. It's controversial. A high proportion of South Africa's wealth is held in retirement funds, and and there's something of over 3 trillion rand held in retirement funds. The question is what to do with those. How do you deal with that? You don't want to disturb savings. You don't want to disturb aspects of ordinary people's funds. In addition to which, there's all sorts of views which are bandied around in the media from sort of populist economists. I use the word economists in inverted commas here, who suggest that if you have a wealth tax, trillions of rands can in fact be accrued to the fiscus. We have serious doubts about that, but what we want to do is to provide a sensible, thought-out report in relation to inter-wealth taxes. We take account of the fact that transfer duty already yields about 8 billion rand, and as I indicated earlier, that is a form of wealth tax, and so we're investigating this, but that is why we feel that the estate duty should be strengthened at present until such time as we've made our recommendations to Treasury agrees with a variation or perhaps the recommendations that we do make in relation to wealth tax, and of course you good men and women of Parliament decide that that's the sort of thing that you want to pass. So that's why we're doing a two-pronged attack. I then turn to tax administration, and perhaps I should turn this over to Professor Laguardia if you want to say anything before I say comment further on taxing, because you're involved. You want me to, and you'll carry on, I'll come to. Okay. So, tax administration has become a really major issue here. I want to stress that we don't see our job, Mr. Chair, as dealing with what might be called the controversial single issues that have hit the press. Obviously, those have to be investigated fully, but our job is to look at tax administration as a whole. And what our job is, and what the ministers asked us to do, in effect, is to say, look, in the 1990s, the CATS Commission of Inquiry set up SARS as an independent body. It decided that SARS would be taken out of the Treasury. The Commission of Inland Revenue at the time was a Deputy Director General in the Treasury. Part of the problem that was faced by the SARS or revenue at that stage was that all of the revenue people were on the public administration books, and therefore the salary structures of a highly specialized people in the revenue service were governed by public administration, and the CATS Commission found that there was a massive hemorrhaging of significant skill. And that was why it was thought, let SARS be an independent body, perhaps where they wished they could pay more to get better skills and to ensure that SARS would be a really first-rate institution. And I think it's fair to say, as somebody who was very instrumental in those recommendations all those years ago, that SARS became a real jewel in our governance crown, in the sense that it really did a fantastic job. The question really is whether in the year 2016 that model still holds. So we want to ask ourselves, going forward, over the next 10, 15, 20 years, is the model that operates in SARS present suitable for all the needs of our economy, and does it promote the principles of accountability, transparency, integrity in the way that the CATS Commission thought it should when it made its recommendations 20-odd years ago? There have also been significant changes to the governance structure. I'll just mention a significant one. In 2002, the SARS Act was changed to ensure that the appointment of the Commissioner of Inland Revenue was made by the President and no longer by the Minister of Finance. Most lawyers would think that on that basis, if you've got the power to appoint, you've also got the power to dismiss, which means that only the President can dismiss the Commissioner. The second issue that applied at the time was the SARS Act in 1997 or 1998 had a supervisory board which was to look over SARS, and it was to be drawn from various sectors of South African civil society apart from permanent members. In 2002, that was significantly altered, and the kind of overall supervisory board no longer continued to exist. What we
we've been looking at and what our job is let's have a look at how other commissioners are appointed, what kind of accountability there is, what supervisory bodies there are. I'll give you an example. In Australia, there's a Board of Taxation, which actually is a totally independent body. It looks at the activities of SARS. It reports to both the Minister and Parliament on a regular basis. It looks at tax design. It looks at tax administration. And it provides an additional feature of governance. And so that's what we're looking at, to see what is best international practice in this particular regard. We're also looking at the current operating model for two or three particular perspectives. We want to know whether, in fact, all of these wonderful recommendations that Professor Gutta and her team have made in relation to base erosion and profit shifting, can we implement them? If we're losing all this money, and we are losing money, there's no doubt about it, because all over the world has indicated, we don't know whether those figures that you cited were totally accurate, but we can be sure that there is, and I've indicated this to the committee before, there is transfer pricing and other forms of activities. Question is, can we implement the recommendations we've made? Is SARS up to the job? And so we want to actually engage with SARS as to whether its operating model can do the job as we feel the job should be done pursuant to our recommendations. We are also particularly keen on looking at the question of high net worth individuals. The committee, the Commissioner of Mineral Revenue has in fact said to us when his office came to us to talk about their operating model that they were particularly interested in a sense, a more specialised investigation unit with regard to high net worth individuals. And I'm talking about people of more than 5 million rand and upwards. And we want to know to what extent that's been implemented, whether it is compatible with international best practice. Similarly, mention has been made of illicit financial flows, which, as Professor Gutta has suggested, is entirely different from the question of transfer pricing. And so we need to know how SARS coping with those questions, and does its operating model, in effect, meet the standards which would be compatible with best international practice. I want to pause there to say we're also dealing with the question of taxpayer rights, and that's where I think you should say something.
Thank you very much, Judge, and good morning, everyone. We have considered over the past few months the fact that there is a lot that needs to be researched and looked at with regards to the taxpayer morality, tax compliance, and the appetite of the South African population to comply with the tax rules of the country. And we have discovered that there is a lot of discontentment by the South African taxpayers with regards to their relationship with the SARS, the usage of the tax monies and the interaction with the SARS in general, and the perceived powers that the SARS has that are not very well balanced with the taxpayer activity and taxpayer rights. We've considered that there's a number of cases where taxpayers consider that the SARS has too much powers that are used and or abused, depending on who looks at it, to the detriment of the taxpayer, their cash flow, and a whole range of issues. So our secretariat, Mr. Pillay, and I attended a taxpayer rights conference in Washington last year, where we actually discussed with tax authorities representatives and tax police representatives from all over the world, and found that we need to embellish the taxpayer rights in the country. We do have the Office of the Tax Ombud that does a very good job of making sure that the SARS processes and systems are applied appropriately with regards to ensuring that the taxpayers are not disadvantaged. However, we find that all over the world, there is good recognition of the fact that taxpayers' rights need to be outlined and vocalized properly and documented properly to make sure that the taxpayers know how what their standing is versus the tax authority. So we are working on a report that is just almost to be completed, where we look at that. We recommend that we need to come up with a taxpayer bill of rights, which is the new trend in the different economies or in the different countries, to protect or to like I said, to explicitly state what the rights of the taxpayers are versus the tax authority. We've also considered the fact that we need to once again embellish the powers and the right and the duties of the tax ombud in a way that would allow the tax ombud to go beyond the systems and the processes and look into the technical aspects also of the interaction between the taxpayer and the tax authority. We would recommend a bit of assistance by the tax ombud in relation to objecting, defending, and or requesting information or further information on tax matters that are before the SARS, where the tax authority and the tax taxpayer might not be in agreement. So what the report will come up with will be more towards an aspect where we believe that when the taxpayers know their rights, they are more willing to comply with the tax authorities, and they are less aggrieved and feel very well protected. Thanks, Judge.
Then finally, last little bits, I know that this committee and Parliament has been looking at the special voluntary disclosure program. It was something that we ourselves recommended very strongly. We're convinced that there's a lot of money out there. It's perfectly clear if you've been following the comparative experience of both in Argentina and in Indonesia, the new special voluntary programs that they've introduced have been overwhelmingly successful. And the reason why they've been overwhelmingly successful, Chair, is because the world has become a smaller place, and because thanks to the HSBC disclosures and the Panama Papers, people now are a lot more nervous. People ask me, how are we going to get $28 billion next year and $15 the year after? Well, I'll get there, but I can say, I think that if we get this thing going, and I agree that I think with what was, I understand, being debated in Parliament, that there should be more time given for this disclosure program to work itself through, I'm convinced that there's significant sums of money out there. And my own view is a simple one. We should be saying, look, this is your last chance. Here's a special voluntary disclosure program. And if you comply, we think it's generous. And if you don't and you're caught, you'll go to jail if properly prosecuted. I mean, we've got to start getting tough about this. We're giving people a real concession here. And sorry, I don't see why everybody in this room has to pay tax or other people can live absolutely the most relaxed fashion, not pay on this voluntary disclosure program, and nothing happens to them. And I think it's really, really important to say, you know, you do it, or alternatively, we will find you. And frankly, they will find you, because you probably know, I'm sure that SARS has already suggested this to you, that if you looked at the Panama Papers, there are very significant numbers of South African taxpayers in that list. And so, you know, these disclosures are going to become more and more the case, and the OECD is putting more pressure on comparative tax administration to disclose that. Then I just want to finally, if I can, with your permission, Mr. Chair, just say a little bit about revenue raising and our way forward. We know that the Minister has has announced that he needs an extra $28 billion in 2016 to 17 and 15 billion, I think 28 billion this year or next year, I can't remember, next year and then another 15. We think that's actually possible, by the way. We don't think that, we think it's not that difficult to find that money. I know Mr. Mania here looks very, very surprised, but I'm saying I think... Well, I think the money's there, and we will make our recommendations. I don't think I'm at liberty to say how I can find that, but I think it is
doable without damaging the economy, and that's the critical point, without damaging the economy. Now, I want to say that's why when you just go back to the SVDP, you know, if you can find 10 or 15 billion additional, you know, you've already taken the 43 down by another 15. That's really good. And our people say to me, oh, but that's only 1 year. And I say that's true. But what we've got to be aiming at is growing the economy to an extent that over the next couple of years, the economy starts getting up to 2, 3, 4%, because then you've solved your problems. I keep on saying to everybody I present to, if we were growing at 5%, you wouldn't need me, because there'd be more than enough tax on. But we do think, just two or three other comments, there's always a big issue about this issue to the tax to GDP ratio. And I should say something about that, if I may. I think there's a lot of nonsense spoken about tax to GDP ratios, and I say this with the authority of the World Bank and the IMF behind me. Because when I went to speak to them and I said, what's our optimum tax to GDP ratio for a country like South Africa? They said, well, what kind of state do you want? And what they meant by that, members, is that they were saying, if you want a state that is going to actually deal with infrastructure and capital expenditure, because you have to reconstruct your society, you will have a higher tax to GDP ratio than a country which perhaps has already got its infrastructure running and where you could take a totally different view. And they said there's no magic formula here. So we need to be less hung up about that and ask a rather more important question. What are we using our tax for? And if you do that, then it seems to me that that's a more sensible question. I know that we've put in here, my dear colleague Vinesh put in here, that we shouldn't consider increasing VAT as a revenue-raising option at this point in time. But I should say the following. Treasury. Oh, sorry. Yes, I was saying. I'm awfully sorry. Yes, we've put there that the Davis Tax Commission does not consider increasing the VAT rate as a revenue-raising option at this point in time. I want to emphasise at this point in time, because I think we've got to start having a national debate about that. And I say this for the following reason. I am extremely exquisitely aware that VAT has retrogressive implications. But many tax commissions, including the Malise Committee in England, have raised the legitimate point that the much more important question is, what do you do with the money? That if the money goes back to the people who, in a sense, need it the most, then to some considerable extent, that actually may well be progressive rather than retrogressive. And we have to face a reality that there are not many other taxes that you can increase to raise significant sums of money. If you take a simple proposition, VAT can 1% VAT increase gets you close to 20 billion. Now, I'm not saying it should happen now, because I'm anxious about two things. One is that if you do introduce VAT now, it does have a depressing short-term effect on growth, and in fact it increases inflation. And I'm not sure that's advisable in the present state of the economy. But I do not want us to be taken to suggest that we can never have a VAT rate increase. My view, for what it's worth, is that we have to look at the possibility of a VAT increase. If you are going to increase national health, if you are going to increase other infrastructural projects, if you are going to deal with sustainability of ensuring that as a very significant part of our population who continue to be impoverished are going to be pulled out of that, we may well need to think about that yet again. But I just want to make that point as clearly as I could. And then finally, we've set out for you certain of the issues that we have, think are themes that emerge. I want to emphasize that tax doesn't solve all the problems. I've already indicated that. I think that when we do increase tax, we have to take account of economic growth, of employment creation, of inequality and poverty. All of those issues are absolute uppermost in our mind. I think that we have, in some instances, far too complicated and onerous tax legislation. I think some of the wording of the tax legislation can only be understood by a genius or an idiot, not by normal people. And I really think we need to think about that very carefully. And I do think that we get the slot, and I'm sure you members do as well, that it's how well we spend the money. And when the money goes to where it's designed, that actually improves tax morality. I'm not suggesting, as has been in the press, that we're at the cusp of a tax revolt. But what I do think is that we do know, and that's why I think the point made by Professor Aguil is so important, that if we have a proper taxpayer's bill of rights, if we have greater accountability, and if we ensure that the expenditure side works as well as it can, it does facilitate the way in which our tax system can work better and in which people will feel, in a sense, more comfortable about paying significant sums of money. I think that basically covers everything, Mr. Chair.
Quickly, I know Judge and your team, it may sound, may feel a bit indecorous, my using the cell phone, but something I would have also felt before I came to this committee. But actually, I've been dealing in almost, in fact, every SMS I had to exchange had to do the work. It's a bad time of the year, because Parliament rises next Wednesday, and, you know, especially with this committee, because we deal with the medium-term budget policy statement shortly before which we'll have budget report and recommendation reports and so on. So I'm dealing with a whole lot of issues related to the program and our own majority party issues and so on. So I was listening to you, and mind you, as I've said to people who appear before our committee before, if you've been around as long as I've been, 4,500 years, and if you've listened to MPs for so long, you can really multitask. When I first came to Parliament, it was hard for me to read and listen. Now I can write a report even and listen to people. And I've asked people to test me. It's a skill you acquire. It's not an intellectual skill. It's actually a skill that derives from utter boredom, listening to oneself and one's colleagues, actually. Say much the same thing. But having said that, so I've heard almost everything you've said, and you can test me if you want. Hand over to members. Thank you. Yeah, can I also say something else very quickly before I throw the... I think the judge needs to know this. You see, Judge Davis, one of the reasons you are here, which you may not know, is I would like you, as a constitutional expert, to tell me whether the behavior of MPs, and it's not the DA, it's my own comrade, is decorous. Is it parliamentary for one's own comrades to challenge the chairperson all the time and to heckle him and to harass him? The DA is a very marginal force here. I mean, there's a lot of noise. The real problem, and there's somebody who's appointed herself as the official chief heckler. She heckles me. Okay? So I want you to observe all of this and write a report. Right? Now, before Mr. Mania gets one of his explosive outbursts, that was a facetious remark. But you will see in this committee that it's the comrades of the ANC that give the chair a hard time. Does this happen in any other parliament in the world? Can you appear before our committee in late January in a meeting to give us a report on your observations? Having said that, can we have the official chief heckler, and then I heard from Mr. Mania, and then it's Mr. Lees, Mr. Futelius, Mr. Futelius, yes.
Thank you, Chair. First, I need to tell the judge that you slashed my tire so that I can be late and not listen to the judge. I had to put a spare wheel in the car. Yeah, I really apologize for being late because we had to put this first.
The story, because yeah. The second time it's happened
it's
in three
it's
weeks.
The second one. It's a different wheel this time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chair, let me first welcome the presentation. I only arrived when the judge spoke to the estate duty and what it currently, the transfer duty yields for the fiscus. But my interest, it's on two aspects. First, it will be on the role of the ombudsperson to look at the issues that taxpayers have raised over time. As parliamentarians, I think we'll have to consider very strongly the views of taxpayers, because we want to promote tax morality. We need a situation where we encourage people to pay more so that the money can come back and do a development programs. You raise a very fundamental question to look at the CATS model, whether it is relevant in the current conjunction. I think we should come back to that debate. I think, Chair, at one point we need to have time to engage so that we do the checks and balances of whether our systems are beyond reproach and compare notes with other systems in terms of... Because I'll make an example. When the National Development Plan was conceived, it was solely on the basis that government wanted to have outside stakeholders to have a share in shaping policy, government policy. So the NDP is on the basis of that, the establishment of a committee of people who were not necessarily serving in government to advise government on policy. So when it relates to these matters also, I think we need, I'm not suggesting anything for now, whether we need a body or whatever, but to look at how we can ensure that SARS remains a solid organization when it deals with, given the past experience where we have had situations, unfortunate situations, which I don't want to delve into. Secondly, I raised a matter with the minister when he presented the MTBPS about having to consider VAT as a source of income for government. It's a very difficult matter for now for engagement, but I believe that value-added tax can make a contribution. And if you can, I know you don't want to give us more insights now on the matter because you want to do more research, but I would want us to look at the possibilities of the role that VAT can play. Well, you demystified the issues on the wealth tax. You know, I became shy because in the NGO where I belong, it was a matter that we were advocating at one stage that we should consider wealth tax. But given the fact that you raise an issue of the retirement contributions that individuals might have made, maybe there was an element of short-sightedness on that matter. So we might want to... So, Chair, I don't know whether the organization has ever thought of inviting Judge Davis to make a presentation maybe on models of taxation to consider so that it doesn't only start and end here, but it starts where policy is shaped so that when we take forth models, it's models that has been given the thumbs up because the issue of wealth tax was debated there and it's a matter that we brought as a mandate to look at, but as it stands, it means it will have to be reviewed for given reasons that it will intrude on personal retirement savings of individuals, which might not be necessarily seen as fair. And looking at our own tax systems, in actual fact, if you are a South African citizen working abroad, your income will not, your retirement income will not be taxed anyway. That's what at some point SARS presented to us. So it will be nonsensical to even take into account having to look at wealth tax. Chair, I will come back to the special voluntary disclosure program and other matters. Let me just pause and then I'll make reflections later. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just four quick questions. I mean, the judge mentioned a tax revolt, which you were quoted expressing concern about in 2015. And in your presentation, you correctly say that tax revenue needs to be spent wisely and prudently, and I think many people would think that that is not the case. Are you still concerned about a possible tax revolt? You did say in your comments that you don't believe that we are on the cusp of a tax revolt, but is it an issue that remains of concern to you? That's the first question. The second question is in respect of tax administration. From your presentation, it appears that you have now, at the request of the minister, launched a new, if you like, investigation or project reviewing tax administration, which traverses, on your version, the appointment mechanism of the commissioner, possibly the division of powers and function between the minister and the commissioner. which means in effect that there's a risk that the Davis Tax Commission inserts itself into the biggest civil war in the country. Are you concerned that that might compromise the Davis Tax Commission and its other work? Thirdly, you didn't mention the sugar tax. I wonder if that had served before the commission or not. And then just finally, your report on tertiary education, which, as I understand in your presentation, a draft report or your final report has been submitted to the minister. I think the whole committee would agree that it would be in the public interest that that report not only be the final report, not only be made public, but also that it be served before the Heifer Commission. Can you give us any kind of assurance that that will happen or if that's your intention? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, interesting. You were saying that people in your profession benefit from the small business tax regime, and that's not really what it was intended for. I mean, the current tax laws amendment bill, which we'll be passing this afternoon, makes sure that personal liability companies are now included, as it's been the practice, despite the law not allowing it over since the regime was introduced. So perhaps we should not be passing that amendment this afternoon and leaving it out. The SDL question, I mean, it's a very valid issue that you raise. Small businesses just fail to access this money. But has your committee looked at the costs of these SDLs and how much, even if you can access it, actually goes back to the people who pay the levies? Now, Annette, you quite rightly, I mean, there's a difference between BEPS and illicit flow. So if one looks at BEPS and the amount of work that's now going into tax agreements, international tax agreements, surely in that sense it should be very easy to identify where the potential movement of funds is going to take place. So South Africa's corporate tax rate is 28% or whatever it is, and the United Kingdom is 42%. Money is not going to go to the United Kingdom on that basis. It might go in terms of an illicit flow, but that's a different thing, as you quite rightly point out. So in your opinion, the BEPS issue, it's a lot more easy to deal with than the illicit flows, and completely different kind of mechanisms, or are they more similar than I acknowledge? Judge Davis, I you must have read my speech for this afternoon, because I'm afraid I might just quote you as well, because we have similar views about the SVDP. We don't like it, but we understand the pragmatism that goes with it, but we also have to say this is the last time, and I think I have to say in future you'll be able to run, but you'll find nowhere to hide. So go to jail, I think, is quite a nice quote. What is, in terms of estate duty, the interspousal abatement, surely that's just a temporary thing? I mean, the wealth moves from me to my spouse dies, the tax is paid. Why is this such a big issue? I had a question here about trusts, and I can't understand my own writing. The question of deeming money in the trust to form part of the estate moves the tax burden from the trust to the estate. So in the end, the tax is now available at point of death and is not taxed in the trust as the trust continues to live for 100 years, earns a revenue, and pays income tax and so on. why is it so important in your mind to bring that into the estate rather than let the tax revenue flow in the trust? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. As the judge was talking, I realized that I should have gone for some counselling, because the last time I had the judge in front of me was in 1984, and it was Justice Wilson. Yeah. So the difference is this one is not wearing a red robe. But no. Thank you very much for the presentation, Judge, and your team. A few observations and perhaps clarifications that I would like to have. Obviously, I think Honourable David has touched on the sugar tax. It was one of my issues. I'll tell you what my concern is. For instance, you can see here that there's an issue with the Minister of Health, and there's a definite problem that he wants to solve. But one of my concerns has always been that we never take the holistic view to the economy, what happens to the economy, how are other industries affected about this, especially in the context of job creation and employment, which is the main thing in the country. And I heard you talking about the models that we have, because it's one of those things that I would have liked to be punched into the model so that we see what the greater implications to the economy are. That's one. But more than anything else, I would like to hear your comments on this text. I hear, Judge, you are quoting in terms of governance of the tax authorities. You are citing what is happening in Australia, which is well and good. The point that I usually raise here is that the choice of the countries that we benchmark with, I think usually there's always a tendency that we default to the first world. Needless to say, whose challenges are very, very much different from what we have. I'm not necessarily anti-West, but I'm just saying that there are all those things which I think it makes sense for us to also go to the jurisdictions who are emerging economies like ours. And I would like to argue, for instance, talking about emerging economies, about Africa in particular, that I would like a situation where we go to north of us and see perhaps whether do we have a better jurisdiction where we can copy from. Yeah, I think generally that's what I would say. Obviously, you said there are a lot of things that we must still come back to. The VAT, there's a lot. I do have an interest in what will happen around VAT and so on. You already mentioned about the regressive nature of that tax. But I think for now I'll park it there. Thank you very much, Chair.
Maybe just one or two comments. One around the sugar tax, and it's a scratch record. I'm not sure, Judge, whether for everything that confronts us as a country, and especially because the context of the sugar tax is more on a healthy lifestyle and other related things. But there are other unintended consequences that may come with some of those things. And I think I agree with Sifi, so that can't we look at the holistic view, because it says those who are in the packaging plant, those who are in the pulp and paper, those who are in transportation, the whole value chain is affected once we start to look at some of those things. And I think we really have to come with a way that we can address some of these things other than looking at tax as the only solution that can deal with that. We are not opposed to that. We really sympathize, and are worried about the level of obesity and challenges that goes with it from the context of what the minister says. But we have to really look at the broader issues around it. But, you know, Judge, we had a debate as this committee in the House around BEPS, and one was looking at the comments of the DTC on how South Africa has been dealing with these things. And I was one of the people who were debating. And what we thought was that from your side, the laws are there to deal with some of these things. But there was also a dissenting view that says there are no laws that are equal to the task. And I think honorable members also spoke about the current amendments that are coming. Well, it's broader amendments around taxation and all those things. But from the BEPS side and illicit flows, are our laws equal to the task? What is the missing link? Do you think the capacity of SARS and the law enforcement units, are they able to deal with some of these things other than saying our laws are not sufficient, for lack of a better word, or where do you think it's a missing link? Thank you very much.
Right. Tandi, yeah. And then Dumasani.
Very quickly.
Members normally first.
Sorry, Chair. Just two issues that I left out. I'm interested on the view of the judge on the issue of trusts. You know, it's very common for everybody to avoid tax, and probably trusts are vulnerable to being used for split income, so that collection can be minimal. I'm not saying it's the case, but I think it's possible that over time the structure of trust can lead to tax avoidance. And I'm using the word avoidance, not necessarily using any other words, to see whether in the context of how South African trusts are structured, do you think it's a possibility that it can be used as a tool to avoid tax? And the last issue is the role of the minister in appointing in the appointment of the commissioner in relation to accountability lines, because in our system it's the appointment is made by a higher office, but the accountability should be relating to the ministry, because the minister deals with the day-to-day running of entities of government. So what's your view on and how should it be shaped to empower such ministers to do their oversight responsibility adequately without limitations? Thanks.
Is from the Parliamentary Budget Office. He's a senior. Next to him is Gloria Mguni, who's also from there. She's just joined the Parliamentary Budget Office. We've, in fact, asked them to do a major study on the VAT. But over to Dumasani.
Thank you, Chair, and morning to the judge and the committee, and morning to our members. There's a perceived, protectionism wave in global economy, which is currently driven by the developed countries. You look at the Brexit, you look at the perceived elections in the U.S., and next year there is French elections in May. And there's quite a lot of concerns of many of the world institutions like World Economic Forum, International Chamber of Commerce, and recently by also the United Nations Conference on Trade Industry to say what does this mean, particularly towards the global recovery from the recent downturns. But I think what is important, this has led to resuscitation of the 1996 the then considered plurilateral agreement by OECD, where there was discussion to have a multilateral agreement on international investment. So that has come to force now to try to deal some of the concerns by many of the countries which are considered to be looking inward compared to, you know, looking quite broadly then. And South Africa has also been seen to be going inward looking as opposed to looking at quite broadly with recent investment legislation that we have enacted recently. But I think my question there, it's about BEPS, Chairperson, because one of the concerns from the African countries is the prevention, is the Action 6 by OECD and G20 project, the Action 6 Prevention of Treaty Abuse. It is a big issue for developing countries, and African countries in particular, as some, most of them are mining and extractive countries there. To say, the question or the comment I want to put to the committee is whether trying to deal with that, the rules on trade abuse, will that in any way provide comfort for developing countries in the perceived multilateral agreement on investment, which is just a discussion, by the way, to say whether that will take place or something. But I think the concern is to say, how do you address the tensions between the developed and developing countries when it comes to investments and the rules around investments, which does affect the economies and the revenues and all of that, that aspect. So I would like the committee to comment on that, to say, will the treaty abuse rules need to be aligned to the United Nations model of tax convention? Will it make it better for the developing countries, particularly the African countries there? So I think there's a one point I wanted to raise there, broadly looking at the economic recovery there. The second point is on carbon tax, Chairperson. The carbon tax, we attended the workshop by the National Treasury in Gauteng, as the judge was referring to it earlier on. And I think there's a quite great consensus that it's a good move by South Africa to try to deal with the behavior and with regards to caring for the environment and so on and so forth. And of course the commitments by the Paris Agreement there. But I think there were three issues there which came to forth. The one was the issue of policy coordination. Because I remember there was some discussion to say, is the approach aligned to South Africa's industrial policy? Is that aligned to it? And how so? And can it be clearly identified, or there is a clear alignment between the country's industrial policy and the approach there? Another point was which I just raised the point, but it was not addressed, but I thought the committee here, maybe they could look into it, the issue of the carbon tax itself as a potentially be seen as a subsidy, to whereby you see that when you look at the modeling side of it, other industries would phase out and others will phase in a way, which would seem as subsidizing other industries over the others there, which might raise a bit of a question when coming to our commitments to the agreement of subsidies and countervailing measures there. Just want to comment on that. And, of course, just a thought that I wanted to put out there. But also, the last point, there was a certainly industry concerns around the tax itself. There seemed to be a lot of lack of uncertainties, and I noted in the slides there's some also concerns there. I just want the committee to comment on these uncertainties and so on and so forth. The other point was, I think the last point that I have, it's on estate duty. I think we had discussion with professional colleagues sometime during the year where the issue was to say, what is the purpose of estate duty? Is it clear, or it needs to be emphasized, or need to be clarified? What is the purpose of estate duty? Coming back to the point that was raised by the judge on the middle class, effect on the middle class, there seemed to be quite a lot of uptake by the middle class who were bearing a lot of the estate duty, which I would assume it was not intention of the estate duty, but there is quite a significant burden on the middle class as opposed to the targeted. But I think the issue is, I think there's a quite need to clarify it. When I look at three options, the one and three, which talks about dwelling with it and maybe emphasizing clearly what
is the purpose of such instrument, more so than the argument that it doesn't contribute much to the revenue pockets compared to other instruments. But again, it's just an issue of re-emphasizing the objective of it and make it more targeted, as opposed to currently being a burden to, it has unintended consequences there. So I want to also add a point, as the judge was mentioning earlier. The other point, raising revenue, I think the issue also which also came in the carbon tax discussion was more about what is the revenue raised will be used for. Is it to be recycled back to the economy, which in a way it will try to lead to more recovery, or is it about plugging a hole in the budget that we have, which also raised the point, say, what is the main objective there? And I think that's where the issue is. What is the purpose of the raising revenue? Is it to plug the hole or to cultivate further economic activities there? So I think it's very important that point I want to mention there. A last point on, I've been saying last point many times now, higher education. There's a report there. I think we'd love to have the report, Judge. The 60 billion, sorry, I just mentioned 60 billion there, which I missed. Is it free for all? Does it refer to free for all? Or for those who qualify, just in touch on that. And does it mean full cost of study? You know, looking at those five variables there. Thank you very much.
Anybody else? Antonia, Gloria? You can come in the second round if you like. Judge, the first thing to say is, I noticed Momo's come in because I was looking for him, or somebody from Treasury. Because one doesn't know exactly, you know, you've done this work for National Treasury. They still have to process the issues.
Done it before.
And I don't know how much you can really say until the matters are processed by the Advocate Jenkins, our lawyer, has left. But I'll leave that to you, okay? I mean, you're a judge. Well, not necessarily, because you have strong views also on the matter. So there are some things, presumably, you still have to process with the ministry and so on. The second thing to say is that this will be part of what we hope will be an ongoing exchange. And my own feeling, the committee can decide, because while I'm sitting with you, I'm also drafting the program, which is to go soon to the House Chair for programs and all that. I think we should seek to meet you twice a year, at least. So this is like a more concentrated way of starting that process, right? The third thing is, in this committee, we are looking into ways of being more productive in our exchange with people who appear before us. And but, you know, we also recognize that people must feel free to speak. Members of Parliament are here, and we come from different traditions and cultures and different backgrounds, and we have different ways of engaging in discourse, right? I think you're very familiar with that, right? And so, you know, my own view is to let people speak. But also at the same time, as our program begins to become so onerous and the time and space available to even do a reasonable job of what we have to do is so limited, we're going to find a balance between people just raising 1,000 questions and people appear before us answering 100 and then they write to us with the remaining 900 answers. And how much time do we have to read them? And also structuring a meeting. I say this because I think you must structure the meeting. I mean, you're very adept and able and adroit at that, right? And organize the themes in your head because you're familiar with the issues. I don't think I need to do that. But I would like to ask a few questions. The other thing to note is that, ideally, it's something about saying that when you organize a particular item of our program, colleagues, it's a tactical consideration in this sense. That you see, this is a very bad period, Judge and team. You know, this last week to 2 weeks, many committees sit, and they're hurtling forward, you know, finishing the program. Now, for example, today, most journalists who cover this cluster are probably in the Appropriations Committee or some other committee right now. Linda's here, but Linda is just one journalist, as important as Business Day is. So, and who's there?
Legal paper from 2024.
From?
2024.
I cannot hear. There's a mic. Why can't you use the mic? Sorry?
My name is Liesl Paper and I'm from Fin24.
Yeah, but you're the financial papers. We really want the people who are popular papers, like the Sowetan, the, you know, that sort of paper, also to cover these issues. Because they have huge effects for the people who actually don't read Business Day and Fin24. So what I'm saying is, Judge, even though the media is not here, it is being cast in the rooms, you know, the audio. So hopefully some of them will pick it up. But having said that, some quick questions, right? One question that may arise is, yes, you need to go to the IMF and the World Bank because they have the expertise. But they also have a certain perspective, so to speak, or ideological disposition. And I'm tempted to ask you, though it's not a serious question, in the 1980s, would you have thought you'll be going to see them so often? But it's a facetious one. Let me ask you, though, are there no alternative agencies that can give you some of their own views and perspectives and a reasonable degree of technical expertise? I'm not saying North Korea. I'm saying, you know, there must be other options. Right? Secondly, I am struck that you're saying the VAT is astoundingly efficient. I saw it somewhere in the media not so long ago. It's one of the most effective in the world. Eh? Can you tell us a bit more why? Then on the border management authority, I can let you know because I think it's in the public domain. The two ministers have met, and I think they're edging towards some compromise. Now, presumably you didn't make a presentation to the hearing, but you submitted a representation to the minister. Okay. Then on, you're looking at base erosion and profit shifting. Was that simply because of your mandate, or did you choose to, or why are you not looking at IFFs, illicit financial flows as a whole? Now, Dubasari Yanchis and them have done some work on base erosion, profit shifting, and IFFs, and I saw the figure, I think it comes from you, Dubasari, that 65% in general of IFFs flows from BEPS, something flows from illicit financial, illicit money move, whatever it is, and then the rest is corruption, 5%. It applies to Africa or the world, I can't recall. So is it not worth looking at illicit financial flows generally? Then the Mbeki report, as it's called for shorthand, it suggests, if I'm correct, over $50 billion are leaving our continent, right? Far more than we get in aid. Now, you know, that figure is not exactly precise, but it's what they came up with. What's your response to that figure? Do you think it's more or less, or do you have no view on the matter at all? Now, respect of our own country, what do you feel about how we're tackling IFF generally and BEPS more specifically? Do you think the laws are adequate? Do you think that, I don't know if you can answer some of these questions because they might be too much outside your purview and the role of a Davis Tax Committee type structure. Do you think SARS has got the necessary support staff, the people have the skills, what can National Treasury say about the six-quin thing, can you say a bit more about that? When you dealt with base erosion and profit shifting, in a nutshell, who were the categories, not every individual representation made to you, who actually made submissions to you? I'll drop the list. But one of the issues that has come up here is the so-called black tax. There's a strata of upwardly mobile blacks, particularly Africans, who feel that the tax system, the tax regime is not sensitive to the historical, cultural, legacy issues. That just as they are beginning to enter classes and strata they were historically precluded from and excluded from, they're now slapped with all these taxes. Of course, one recognizes you can't apply a tax. Well, you could, I don't know. Is it tenable to say, well, people of color or disadvantaged people, Africans in particular, who earn a certain income because of cultural and other issues, pay differently from a historically advantaged person? I don't know whether those issues come up in some of the work you do, but it certainly comes up in this committee. It has been brought to our attention, and when we bump into people who are aware that we serve in this committee, it has been raised with me and at least one other member in this committee who feels quite strongly about it, raised it here, and we asked for people to appear in a public hearing, and for some reason they didn't turn up. On the issue of the governance of SARS, that matter came up. There's nothing to hide. I don't know why Tandy is so coy about it. It's in every other public discourse about the high-risk investigation unit, sometimes called the rogue intelligence unit. Right? The issue did arise then that shouldn't there be some governance structure, some board? I'm not sure why the idea of a board was dropped. Somebody raised me not so long ago, I can't recall who, that in the revenue services of other countries, both in the developed and developing world, there is some sort of governance structure. But then will that complicate the relationship with the minister and or the president, right? Even if the president appoints the commissioner, as he does with other public entity representatives, the issue that needs to be clarified, because again, this isn't the public domain. Our reply, and me in particular as a chair, when the media rings me, as often they do, knowing full well that I can't really say anything more than what the law allows for. So I say to them, yes, whatever the law says, if the commissioner is answerable to the minister, he must be answerable to the minister. If the minister cannot interfere in certain issues, then the minister must abide, everyone is abide by the law. So I give them a platitudinal, bland response. But there are grey areas in this regard. Even if the president appoints the commissioner, surely there has to be some relationship between the minister and the commissioner. And surely that should be clarified in law or in regulation somehow. So the governance issues have arisen in this very committee around the time that the HRRU was put in the public domain. It remains an issue right now because in the media it's now said that the new commissioner has appointed a similar type investigative unit, right? And really, this committee will have to address it at some appropriate stage, and it'll happen in the first quarter of next year. So what I'm saying, those governance issues are things this committee will have to deal with at some stage or the other. So in short, there are too many issues you've been asked. Can I suggest you organize them in themes? You reply, and then if members are very terribly unhappy that you haven't responded specifically to any specific question, they are free. We've got up till 5 to 1. I have to leave because I have a meeting with the Whippery on our side. But let me put this to you. If it's not even, we're actually asking you to do this. The other reply that you haven't attended here, what's the word, haven't presented here, offered here, you can organize them in pretty sharp, simple, short replies, and then we'll see how we take the matter forward. We'll hand it over to our research team and say to you, Judge and your team, please come again. And that will not be before March, certainly, because, you know, the first 6-8 weeks of Parliament, when they get back, are just overwhelmingly directed towards budget and those tax bills.
Very much, Chair, and to members. I'm going to try to be brief, and I'm going to try to deal with almost everything as I can in themes. Right. The first thing is the sugar tax. I can't talk to you about it because it wasn't our recommendation. We had nothing to do with the sugar tax. This tax caught me as much surprise as I suspected caught members. Why it's there, I haven't the slightest idea. I have real doubts about taxes which are supposed to change behavior, particularly ones which are retrogressive. I've always thought to a large degree we all chuckle and say it's fantastic that we got taxes on beer and taxes on cigarettes and all that. And of course, those are often the things that make working class life bearable, and then we tax them. These are serious questions. And I'm also not certain how much money this damn thing is going to bring in. And because it's clear that if it brings lots of money, it's a retrogressive tax. Because, you know, I have sympathy with the idea that you want to change behavior. I'm a diabetic myself. So I'm worried about that, but I can't answer any of those questions because, frankly, for reasons which I do not even begin to understand, we were not even asked about it, not consulted about it, we were not even given any chance to make representations with regard thereto. If I can, I'm sorry about that. When it comes to the question of which was asked quite often, I want to be clear about this. I agree entirely with the point. That has to be debated because it is the easiest and probably most efficient source of revenue that's available to us. Of course, one has to be careful about, as I say, the short-term effects and the retrogressive nature. But that's something that's solvable, and that's why this idea that it's something, a holy cow that you can't go near, seems to me to be really constraining our tax policy in ways that we need to deal with far more, I think, intelligently than we've done. Let me say, in relation to that, yes, we're certainly going to be producing another report, and yes, Mr. Chair, I would very much appreciate coming back to speak as often as you would like, because these engagements are extremely useful to us in kind of knowing, you know, where we stand on matters. In relation to the question of the tax revolt, I said at the time that I was anxious that obviously if you have a situation that there's a perception or even reality that money isn't going to where it's designed to go, you clearly do have
problems of tax behavior. I don't think the statistics show that now. That's what I'm saying. If you look at the tax statistics, it doesn't show that we're having that. But you can't take taxpayers for granted. It's a simple point. And therefore, the greater the integrity throughout the system, the more likely that we'll have greater tax morality. And there's no doubt that I'm sure members have had the same sort of feedback that we've had, which is, you know, well, if we were sure the money was going to go to X, Y, or Z, people would pay more. And so there's that part too. In relation to the question of the so-called civil war, Mr. Mania, that is why I thought I'd been so careful. It's not for us as a tax committee to investigate, let's say, particular questions. I mean, let me give you an instance, and let's not be coy about it. I understand the commissioner has instituted some investigation into the Mr. Makwakwa case. Whether that's satisfactory is not for me to comment on. Right? That has to be investigated comprehensively is so obvious that I don't think I have to say it. But it's not for a tax committee looking to where our system should go over the next 10 or 15 years to have to start running, as it were, disciplinary inquiries or that sort of one or another. Where I think we have to get involved is in questions of broad policy. Do the risk management protocols of SARS stack up sufficiently? And that goes to point that the chair's asked on least. And a number of other members, take things like illicit income flows, which are very serious, I agree. And we have, in fact, interacted with Mbeki, the committee. They came and they made a presentation to us, and we had an actual serious engagement with them. I can't tell you whether those figures are utterly accurate. One of the problems we face is that all sorts of figures are bandied around all over the show, and when you start testing them, you can't be sure. But there's no doubt that they're onto something substantial. So if you take that, we've got to be able to ask, right, Commissioner, how are you dealing with illicit income flows? Is your model good enough? Are these issues ones that can be applied properly? I know there's lots of in the public domain about the so-called rogue unit. The truth is that tax administrations around the world have special units to deal with illicit flows all over the world. There's nothing illegal about it. That's what they do, and that's what they should do, and we need to know where that money is. So we need to investigate those questions. So, no, I don't want to get into any civil war, but I do want to ensure that our committee comes up with the best possible recommendations in relation to the broad principial questions which underpin tax administration. And I take the point readily, because of course we shouldn't only look at Australia and England and America, etc. That point's taken seriously, and of course we broaden our scope. All I wanted to say by way of illustration, so as not to be confused, was that there are many countries in the world, just took Australia as one, since I've been there recently, was talking to their tax office, which is a very efficient one, is that they have an independent body, which in a sense provides information to you good ladies and gentlemen from Parliament in their country, and to the minister, so that you've got layers of accountability. And it's critical, because if you look at the various pieces of legislation that SARS actually administers, they've got enormous powers, enormous. And principles, you know, there's no reason why those principles of integrity and accountability and transparency shouldn't apply there. So I take the point, and I'm quite sure that we'll be able to provide you with developing country precedent which supports the arguments that I've developed until now. In relation to tertiary education, of course, if the minister, it's not for me to publish these reports, the minister can. What we did, and let me just clarify again, was I got extremely anxious about the fact that there we were sitting as a tax committee, and I've often wondered why, in fact, you know, if you've got a tax committee, why don't you come to us? I mean, if we're talking about how you fund national projects like national health, why don't you simply come to us and say, well, can you fund national tertiary education? How can you do it? So we were sitting there, and people like myself who teach at university, I should add for free just in case anybody suggests I earn anything from that, and were having our, you know, not being able to lecture, I was extremely concerned, as everybody else was, and could we do anything? So we sat down, three members, two of my, who are not present today, Professor Woolard from UCT and Tanya Ajram, myself, and Dr. Greg Spall, who's from Stellenbosch, who's an educational economist. And we puzzled out what would things look like. I don't know whether just an answer, 60 billion is the accurate figure. What I can tell you is it's got to be around that amount if you take everything into account. That means board and lodging, books, and also taking into account tertiary colleges and not just universities. And we said, well, there's no way we could do that. We gave illustrations as to how that would have to be and why that would be under pressure. But we made a number of suggestions, and I will certainly write to the minister and suggest, and you're very welcome to do so the same. You may have more influence in relation to get... Well, I'm very humble about my position in this regard, Chair. Okay, in which case I will write. Okay. So insofar as that's concerned, that's the answer to that. I'm going to leave the BEPS questions to Annette, and also there's an issue about the tax on, but I'm going to leave to Professor Guo. I want to just, some of the questions that were posed in relation to trusts, I'll tell you what the problem is. The problem with the trusts is this. It is an income-splitting device. All over the world, people are worried about that. Why are you worried about it in terms of state duty? Because if I've got an asset that I know is going to grow very rapidly, and I set it at a very before it does so into the trust, all the growth gets taken up in the trust. I in fact don't have any of that growth added to my estate. Fine. But if I then control the trust and treat the trust almost as if it's my own, I'm getting away with no estate duty, yet I'm enjoying the fruits of the asset. And that's what's happening. Why are we worried about the abatement? Not because of the abatement on its own, but because we're worried if you actually do a usufruct to the wife and then you split the usufruct of the bare dominium to the children, you can actually save an unbelievable amount of estate duty over a period of time, and it's a massive abuse, and in fact you collect no money as a result of that. In relation to the question of the wealth tax, all I'm going to say about that is that that is under investigation. Why did we choose to do what we did at present? Because if you did nothing, then you'd have no taxation on wealth at all. And I thought we made out that case reasonably in our initial report, and accordingly we say if we've gone through a wealth tax, we'd be in a position to say whether that tax is superior to a state duty. In this case, we didn't. And since we had a system that works and could work better, why not use it, which is what we decided in relation to that. In relation to the small business corporations, what was worrying us there was the fact that when you looked at who got the benefits of that $1.36 billion, they were all these sorts of companies that you could say to yourself, but those aren't the ones that are generating jobs. And therefore, why, in fact, give up $1.36 billion for that effect? That's really the thrust of that particular argument. In relation to the carbon tax, which has been raised on a number of occasions, yes, I mean, our initial view was we weren't sure what the effect was going to be, and nobody could tell us properly. Nobody could, and, you know, I'm told, is it 13 billion, is it 5 billion? I don't know. What I know is that if there's an X sum of money, I want to know damn well before I actually implement it that it's not going to fall on poor people. I just don't want it to happen. So when I looked at the modelling that came to us in the last couple of days, I can see what they're trying to suggest, and I'm not sure that it actually meets the objections we've had. And I suggest we actually interrogate that very carefully before we come to a final conclusion. So I'm pretty much in agreement with the proposition on that. In relation to the IMF and the World Bank, you're dead right, of course. And if you say, as I know you did provocatively, would I have dreamt in the 1980s that I would be consulting the IMF and the World Bank? Well, frankly, Mr. Chair, if I was in the 1980s, I'd have been a judge. I would have thought I'd be completely nuts. So things do change in life. But I do think that the IMF and the World Bank, of course, should not be the only group, and they aren't. We do consult more broadly than that. Where they are extraordinarily useful is on econometric models, which give you a mathematical indication of certain aspects. It's very hard to find anybody else who's got the money or the willingness or the expertise to do that. And so when you asked us about the VAT, how do we know that that worked? It was because we had this, I mean no disrespect to him, he was, I think, a Chinese economist, and I thought that when he spoke, he could only speak in algorithms or Mandarin, because I didn't understand a word he said. But when the actual report came out, you know, what he showed through the mathematical model that he did was that our system was unbelievably efficient, and his argument for that, and they do a very sophisticated set of mathematical models, having got from Treasury and from SARS all of the economic accounts so that they can then test what you could expect to get and what you did get. And the reason that we get what we get is because if you have a very narrow band of zero rating and you have a very narrow band of exemptions and you have one rate, it's much more difficult to arbitrage the system than if you had a high rate and a low rate. So a lot of people say what we need to do is not have keep 14%, but then for very luxury items have 20%. Well, the argument is that when you see that, then the evidence indicates that, in fact, you hemorrhage quite a lot through the arbitraging of the system. So that's how we know in that particular regard. Again, I agree with you that we don't suggest, for example, that base erosion profit shifting is more important than illicit income flows. To the contrary. And that brings me back to the point. It's not that I am reluctant to have another indemnity amnesty program. I know that Treasury, members of Treasury argued quite fulsomely that, you know, surely not another one. But my point is a simple one, is that other countries have realized we're in a different context now. Because from a world perspective, the level of disclosure of illicit flows and of tax shenanigans is in a different space than what it was in 2003 when we introduced the previous one. And frankly, we need the money, and we need to bring people in. So yes, it is a reluctant thing, but I have to say, and I'm delighted that you agree with that, I hope that everybody would agree with that in fact you get one final chance, and if you don't do it, then perhaps you'd like to spend some time at the expense of the state in rather more precarious accommodation than you probably live at present. So that's why we've done that. I think broadly I've covered most issues other than for... Sorry, what's... Oh, hang on. What I think... Oh, it's a border management agency. We obviously dealt with the minister... of finance in that particular regard, and insofar as that is concerned, yes, we made our recommendations to him. We have not liaised with the Department of Home Affairs, but we're very, very emphatic. If there's a compromise, that's fine, but our view was clear that it should remain exactly as it is, but if there's a compromise, that's beyond our things. I'll only make one point about BEPS, because the rest will be up to Professor Guto. Is that in relation to the mandate, yes, it was part of our mandate. It was an express view that we had to deal with this question. By the time we got going in 2013, base erosion and profit shifting was centrally on the agenda of most countries. And there was a point made by a member, quite rightly so, and I suspect from your budget office also quite rightly so, that part of the problem that we face is an international regime which is skewed in favor of the developed world. And one of the things, Trey, that maybe we should talk about at another meeting is how we, as part of the BRICS countries, actually start instituting further debate in the broader world global community about fact of tax systems which, in a sense, are more advantageous to the developing world rather than only talking to the developed country book, which is exactly, I should tell you, where too much of the OECD recommendations located at present. I can certainly give you quite a lot of reading. In fact, I think somebody who you know pretty well as well, Professor Picciotto, has written quite a lot about that particular proposition. In relation to the black tax on income. I've heard about it, but we haven't had any submissions in this particular regard. I prefer not to say much about it, although I'd be interested in engaging further with that proposition. The only thing I can say is that if you take a state duty seriously, well, then the fact that it's probably going to capture the accretion of wealth that occurred prior thereto, and at least that to some extent, does address the problem, albeit only tangentially. You want to? Yes, of course.
The preoccupation,
yeah.
Maybe the professor can answer. We feel that the people responsible for illicit financial flows are getting away far too flagrantly. I don't know what the word is. It's outrageous. And we would like to see people inside the court system. We need to set an example. The Panama Papers process looks like it's torturously slow. Base erosion and problems. We need to put people inside the court process. They must face trial. So we raised this thing 2 weeks ago or whenever. Have you got any proposals on what government can do?
Yes, I do.
Right? So that's the one issue. Secondly, is it the case, our colleagues in mining, they say to us that that's where a lot of the base erosion and profit shifting occurs. Firstly, is that accurate? Secondly, is it the case that economies that are based on commodities, mining economies, are more vulnerable to base erosion and profit shifting than elsewhere? Although when Dubasani and his team came around, there's also a whole lot of stuff about digital economy and, you know, the intellectual property issues and so on. So in short, are we more vulnerable because we're a mining economy in the sense we are?
Well, of course, base erosion profit shifting to a very large extent, he's right, Masani, is very much in the modern era linked to intellectual property and shifting of royalties and creating of kind of patents and other forms of intellectual property and then shifting your royalties into tax havens and ensuring to a large degree that you suck the money out on that basis. It is true, however, that economies such as ours, extractive industries, quite a lot of shenanigans occur. All I can say on that is that that is one of the reasons that we have. I understand from the commissioner, I don't want to misquote him, but that he's very concerned about this to his credit, and that apparently there's a Canadian group coming out to reinforce the transfer pricing units within SARS. One of the problems that SARS has is when they get real talented people in their hub, because they're so in scarce demand, they then land up by getting into the private sector. So there's that issue. In relation to the question of illicit flows, yes, I do. I mean, I think that quite honestly, as I understand it at present, both on the Panama Papers and on the HSBC disclosures, there were many South African names there. Now, I think that there probably are, in fact, I'm sure there are cases there, for reasons that I prefer not to disclose, that were illegal. And here's the thing. How then do you do that? Well, that depends on the national prosecuting authority. And so I'm afraid, you see, this is where institutions are linked one to the other. And so leave aside all the controversy about whether they understand the question of the theft and corruption. Let me put this bluntly. And by the way, I mean, I say this with my hat as a judge president of the Competition Appeal Court, because as you know, Minister Patel has now introduced legislation dealing with the question of criminalising cartel behaviour. The same issue arises there. Where are we going to get the expertise in the NPA to deal with it? Now, if we're going to prosecute illicit flows, you've got to have a couple of prosecutors there who really commercially have commercial expertise. So I have a solution to the problem. The problem is that we need to look at that institution, get a really targeted group in there, so that when these cases come to court, and they should be coming to court, you've got the sort, because you can be sure of one thing, that the crooks on the other side will have hired the most fancy schmancy lawyers. And so I'm saying I think that's an issue that we should be debating, Chair, and it just goes to show you that when you debate one issue, it's inexplicably linked to another, but that is my view on that.
Before we come to your prof, I think we want some help on ideas on what we do to bring all the parties together. We're thinking in January or early, whenever we can, the first quarter, of bringing the SAPS committee, the police committee, ourselves, mining, economic development, etc., etc. So on that matter, is it on illicit financial flows only? I'm going to allow some input here.
It's on that matter, because you see, The limitations is that when illicit flows takes place, the judge says that the security cluster must be involved. I have a problem somewhere. One, I'm not sure whether there's expertise in the NPA to pursue such. So I thought when you said a specialized unit within SARS, I thought that we were going to facilitate a process through legislation where we empower SARS to do special investigations that relates to that in particular. Because, and I'm not implying anything, but I want to make an example. In an event that SARS believe that this is an important case to pursue, it's high profile, and then the NPA believes it's not an important case to pursue, it means what we'll be dealing with when it relates to illicit trade will not achieve the results intended to. And we're saying we believe that there is money sitting somewhere, and if proper work can be done, we can draw a lot of money that we can use in the fiscal. So we need to, when we move towards that process, to get suggestions. I'm pleading with the judge, actually, to give us suggestions as to how can we strengthen the role of SARS without diluting it and sending it to another unit.
When you have that hearing, okay?
One comment, very briefly.
Yeah.
I agree with you. Here's the point. Part of what we were indicating in our tax administration report, and in fact when we have already engaged with the commissioner, is how do we strengthen that arm of SARS? How do we, you know, and we're interested in engaging him further as to what his plans are and how we can help him. Because our object is to make SARS better, so we agree with you entirely. But they're linked, because even if we do as we must, have a specialized unit that deals with all these questions with the best possible expertise we can, at some point, that investigation would hopefully give rise to a prosecution in the courts. And so at the same time that we do that, we've got to think through how will we, in fact, ensure that the NPA is up to ensuring that those people's prosecutions are successful. So there's a two-pronged strategy. And I'm happy to talk further with you, but I'm simply saying we are engaging with the Commission on precisely that issue.
Thank you so much. Now, the issue of the convergence between BEPS and illicit financial flows is a very important issue and matter that is being addressed both nationally and internationally with the Thabo Mbeki report and the discussions that are taking place at UN level. Especially when you see the Panama Papers that we've just talked about here and the revelations that are coming out of there and seeing the likes of David Cameron just getting a slap on the wrist regarding estate planning, and then we see the Prime Minister of Iceland having to resign because of this. It is important for us to get a convergence between illicit financial flow and BEPS. But as the international tax framework stands right now, the two are different, and the approaches to resolve the same are different. So this is our approach in the Davis Tax Committee report. We have not shied away from addressing the issues of illicit financial flows. We have a whole section in there. But it is important for us to understand that the way the international fiscal framework stands right now, the two are different, separate issues. And until we get a discussion that brings the convergence of the two, then that is a different issue altogether. And it has to be an international discussion, not an issue that South Africa can come up as a country on itself, because these are international schemes that take place. You can't have South Africa coming up with its own laws and the rest of the international community going away on another issue. But the problem that we have had at UN level with the Thabo Mbeki report is that there has not been a universal agreement of what illicit financial flows are, and the boundaries and what it really covers have been quite blurred. But what we have insight about what it covers is generally movement of monies between countries in ways that contravene the laws and the regulations of the countries involved. I gave an example of illegal activities from a tax perspective. You have your tax evasion, but it generally covers issues like organized crime, customs fraud, money laundering, terrorist financing, including bribery. But the ultimate thing that overarches all these illicit activities is that they are not recorded, and they cannot, you cannot use them when it comes to public funds. You'll find a lot of private investment capital in the countries that, you know, all types of these activities come from. The issue around it is the secrecy involved, and that secrecy is the connection that comes into play when you talk about BEPS. With BEPS, we're talking about multinationals using legal methods or apparently legal methods to circumvent the laws of the countries involved, including the lack of proper tax administration and the capacity to fully audit and assess the international tax risks. The OEC does acknowledge that even in BEPS, there are cases of illegal abuses, although it does say that these are an exception rather than the rule. But for now, when we look at the Panama Papers, the issues I've just explained now, and all the secrecy that's involved, there are lots of question marks. Is it really the exception rather than the rule? But anyhow, before we get into there, the most important thing is to know it is the secrecy that has been involved, and secrecy behind it is the reason why we have had all these tax havens, your Panamas, your Jersey, and all the different types of tax havens that are there, whereby people, you know, invest into there and make sure that their domestic legislation can't be able to deal with those issues, can't be able to expose their activities there. And this results into the blurring of the dividing line between illegal tax evasion and tax avoidance. Tax avoidance is supposed to be legal, so to speak, and evasion is what is illegal. But one thing that we know, because of the secrecy in both BEPS and the secrecy that fuels illicit financial flows, both of them impact on revenue collection. So the overarching issue we should be dealing with is capital flight. Is it illicit or licit, so to speak? When it comes to illicit financial flows, and that is where the EFF comes in, the IFF comes in, then we are looking Then we are looking to criminal prosecution. So you're looking at criminal prosecution, you're looking at crime intelligence coming in there, you're looking at what the police can do, you're looking at what anti-corruption units can do. So the approach for dealing with the two differ in the current domestic and international fiscal framework. That we must understand. Because we can't combine the two together. If we think that we are going to approach the same together, then we are going to miss it. So the work of the OECD has been to deal with the BEPS issues that arise out of the capital flight. And then, but one thing, like I said, because of the secrecy involved, automatic exchange of information is going to be very, very helpful in exposing both. And that's where I come to the question that you have just raised, the role of double tax treaties. Double tax treaties, currently we have your Article 26 in double tax treaties, which is supposed to encourage exchange of information between countries, and now they've taken it a step further and they have automatic exchange of information. We have already legislation in South Africa that was enacted in 2015 to encourage automatic exchange of information. Where we don't have a treaty with a specific country, for example, many tax havens do not sign double tax treaties. There is usually what they term the tax information exchange agreements, or your TIAs, which encourage countries to take to get into treaties of exchange of information, even if there is no double tax treaty in place that deals with generally income tax issues. And then there is a multilateral agreement that was developed for OECD countries that has been opened out to all other countries to join, which will also help to expose this type of thing. And it has been taken further in your Action 13. Now we have country-by-country reporting. It is going to help and reveal most of these things, both illicit and licit. So I've taken major focus now on the BEPS issues. What about the illicit financial flows? What can SARS do? The one of the most important, one of the most, the big things about illicit financial flows that falls within the purview of what SARS can do is tax evasion. If SARS picks up that it is tax evasion, all it will do after that is to pass over the issue to criminal investigation. If it's a tax avoidance issue, then we have the legislation in place to deal with that. And that has been the focus of the BEPS Tax Committee, looking into the legislation we currently have in the country. And I'm glad to report that South Africa actually has one of the strongest, robust systems to deal with some of the BEPS issues that we are dealing with, comparable to even the developing countries, and even stronger. Some of our legislations are actually very punitive and very strong, like the CFC legislation that is actually preventing foreign direct investment. So we are not looking only at issues of how the legislation can be improved to deal with BEPS, but also how to lighten some of the legislation that is actually preventing foreign direct investment in terms of the National Development Plan. And the other issue that SARS can deal with, because someone was talking, someone asked the question, how can we strengthen SARS to make sure that we deal with this issue? We shouldn't forget that even if these are illicit issues, we have the voluntary disclosure programs to reveal some of the secrecy involved, although they could be shredded under tax avoidance. We have rules to regulate the activities of tax practitioners, because don't forget that they are at the center of crafting some of the schemes that taxpayers get involved in order to invest in some of these offshore jurisdictions. But we have rules that regulate these tax practitioners. And sometimes we put it's important for us to acknowledge the steps that we have taken. Okay. Otherwise, if we are going to measure the tax gap in South Africa, we'll go on a goose run, thinking that we have some trillions of dollars that are out there, and yet it is a certain amount. Should the focus be so much on BEPS? Do we have a lot of effort we've put in there? Or should the focus be so much on illicit financial flows? So we need to know where the gap really is. But I'm glad to report that when it comes to the domestic systems we have in South Africa, they are not perfect, but they are comparable. We have reviewed each one of them. The biggest concern that we have with the South African tax law is that they are too blurred and mixed up, that they create loopholes or opportunities to manipulate. We have the legislation in place. Maybe we need more capacity, but the systems we have in place, but because they are all over the place and they clash with one another, CSC legislation, transfer pricing legislation, those who are experts in these things find it much more easier to manipulate the system. But there are lots of stop gaps that we have, and don't forget that we also have the exchange control provisions. Now, I need to explain this matter that has been causing a lot of misunderstandings when it comes to EFFs and BEPS. One of the major issues that SARS can deal with is customs fraud. That falls under IFS. They should really be not in there. That is a customs fraud, and that is where trade mispricing falls. Trade mispricing is an IFF issue. It is not a BEPS issue. It is different from transfer pricing. So there is a lot of misunderstanding. Transfer pricing is not the same as trade mispricing. Trade mispricing is a customs fraud issue whereby they deal with the receipts and underprice or overprice, and that is a concern that we have when it comes to commodities. There is a lot of trade mispricing when it comes to mining industry, the underprice or overprice, the kind of commodities that are being sold, and this is a matter that falls under the customs unit in SARS. Transfer pricing is a BEPS issue. Transfer pricing deals with multinationals and how the prices they placed on the goods and services that they transfer between one another, either underpriced or overpriced, in order to beat the tax system and shift profits from low tax to high tax jurisdictions. The two should not be confused. If we confuse issues relating to BEPS and IFS, we are not going to get anywhere. So what we have done in the BEPS report is to create clarity. This is what we are dealing with, and this is what we are dealing with. I've already told you, when it comes to IFS, when each SAS deals with a tax evasion matter, they take it to criminal investigation and all that, and maybe we need to strengthen that. I've talked about, for example, mandatory disclosure programs. We already have that legislation in South Africa. There are reportable arrangements. Okay, SARS has taken proactive action. If you are dealing with any tax avoidance schemes, you need to report it even before you start, including the people that are involved in the scheme and those that will benefit from that. So we've looked at the positives that we've had. We looked at the gaps that we have, but there is a distinction between BEPS and IFS. That we have explained, and we have not shied away from it. I hope I've explained that properly. Yes, someone asked about, are our laws equal to the tax at hand? I think I've addressed that.
Yeah.
The laws regarding BEPS and the laws regarding IFS, I've explained that the secrecy in between can be dealt with at international level when we have the double tax treaties in agreement, and country-by-country reporting should come forward. But I strongly believe that the way things are going, there has to be a discussion at international level. When we have exposures such as those in the Panama files, what can be done about it? It's not something that South Africa can take on all by its own. At international level, there has to be a way that people like David Cameron don't just get a slap on the hand. There should be proper prosecution that takes place. Action 6, someone asked a question about Action 6 and treaty abuse and its impact on developing countries. This is a very important matter for developing countries, and we do provide solid recommendations in our BEPS report. The OECD does recommend that treaties as they stand right now only cover tax evasion, okay, preventing double taxation. Yes, they don't deal with double non-taxation. So what the OECD now provides is recommending that the treaty should cover treaty shopping, and they recommend use of the principal purpose test and the LOB provision, which I won't go in right now. But the comment that you had is the impact of tax treaties and the investment agreements, right, that we enter. This is a very, very pertinent issue, because we have double tax treaties on one side, and then we do also have bilateral investment agreements, for example. And South Africa has come up with a new policy that is reviewing our bilateral investment agreements. But for me, maybe something I want to point out is the fact that in the bilateral investment agreements, there are arbitration provisions that taxpayers can get involved in. And these have created a way in which taxpayers actually beat the system. If they fail to get relief in the double tax treaty, they can seek for relief in the bilateral investment agreement. And this is a major concern for developing countries. If you've been following the heritage case, for example, in Uganda, where they had to use an arbitration provision and take the case all the way to the UK to deal with the monies, and that was in trillions, I think, or billions of Ugandan shillings that were being lost. The fortunate thing is that at least Uganda won the case. But the concern for South Africa regarding this particular issue of double tax treaties and bilateral investment agreements is the silos that we have in the system. National executive is the one that has got to ensure that a treaty comes into effect in the country. But then you have the Department of Trade and Industry that has got to deal with issues that have got double tax treaties. SARS has got to deal with those issues. National Treasury also has. And if all these bodies are not talking to one another, we have a situation where a politician gets with country X, sees that maybe there is a treaty that is required, signs the treaty, but if they are not looking at the tax implications, the treaty will be signed and then SARS or National Treasury has to deal with the raw deal that could have been signed because they were not contacted before the treaty itself was signed. But I think SARS is looking into those issues. There is a way, it's not yet perfect, but I think the discussions are taking place to ensure that the treaties that we have in place are actually to our favor. There are a lot of new treaties that are being negotiated. One that should be worth of concern was the treaty we had with Mauritius that has been renegotiated, and many of the roadies that we have in there have been dealt with. So that is the long and short of my story, but for you to know that we have not shied away from discussing issues of BEPS and AFS. And please, any discussion that deals with this must have a clear understanding of the distinction between the two. Thank you.
We've got about 12:44. We need about a few minutes to structure our program this afternoon, so can you be slightly brief and you can... No, Tandy, I'm afraid not.
Thank you.
No, well, that can cover the end. Can we let them speak, please? Yes.
Thank you, Chair.
To 1 hour meeting. Can you chair the meeting and you can give yourself a lot of space to talk? Like Stanley will chair at 5 to 1. You can carry on till 2 o'clock. Remember, we've got to go to after 2. Yeah.
Thanks, Chair. Quite interestingly, the person that you referred to as the chief heckler, yes, asked the question as to whether we have looked at the SARS and how the SARS could be strengthened to be able to administer the tax and manage it properly, or the tax system. You know, we acknowledge that we've looked at the SARS and the structures at the SARS, these developments at the SARS where the new structure has been put in place. We have concerned ourselves quite importantly with looking into the fact that the work that we have done on BEPS, the work that we're doing on other areas would go to waste if the SARS is not able, does not have enough resources, human resources to administer. And, you know, we've looked at the numbers and it is acknowledged that the SARS is not does not have sufficient people, sufficient skills, and needs embellishing, needs a whole lot more people, a whole lot more technical persons to help in the administration of this tax. I mean, we have seen that from our research that it's not only the SARS that has a problem. Tax authorities throughout the world have the same problem. The judge spoke a little bit about the Border Management Agency. We find it very important that the integrity of the SARS needs to be maintained. The SARS needs to be kept with all the powers that it has, and for various reasons that I do not have time to go into, we have found that we cannot have the Border Management Agency intervene or interfere with the powers of the SARS of collecting the revenue for those reasons. Thanks.
Draw to a close. Unless, look, can I just get some clarity? Do you want to say till about 1:15?
No, Chair, I won't be long.
No,
I won't
okay.
be long.
Because then I'm serious. I've got to leave at 5 to 1.
Yes.
You can chair.
First, I will make a request that we get the BEPS report for ease of reference on the issues that we can deal with. Secondly, I wanted to suggest that we have a joint meeting with the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry and International Relations to discuss the very same issue of treaty abuse and to look at the recommendations we can make in relation to the bilateral investment agreements that the DTI and DICO do with countries that might be tax havens, so that we solidify the position that we have taken. Because the suggestion is that we need an international convergence point in relation to BEPS and illicit financial flows. So if that's the case, then we have to sit with these committees and make recommendations. So that's the recommendation I wanted to make.
Yeah, but it's already in the pool of issues we're having. Remember, the DTI committee, mining and ourselves are the three lead committees. We're obviously the main committee. So the follow-up meeting in the first quarter of next year, all we've got to do is add that issue in, but that's exactly what we are going to do. Fine. Having said that, Judge, 2 minutes, and then we've got to draw to a close. Do you want to say anything?
The BEPS reports are on our website, and including executive summaries thereof.
Good.
Yes, Chair. I mean, as you can see, we don't agree with everything that the committee says, but that's their job, to provide independent advice, and I think they're doing a sterling job, and we do disagree quite often, but whether it's carbon or sugar, I can go for his figures, but we'll do that separately.
Quickly about this afternoon, right? Now, as I understand it, because this morning when I raised it, there's uncertainty. Maybe, Mr. Mania, you know. Now, I hope Tandy is listening, because you're responsible for the rates and monetary and DTA, right? Now, as I understand it, Mr. Mania, I told them what you said, which is you don't really want a declaration on DTA. Is that correct? Has that changed?
So if I recall correctly, our agreement is there'd be a declaration on rates and monetary and then a short debate on the tax bills, which are packaged.
Yeah. 73 minutes. DTA, you're not going to. No. But you see, why you should prepare, because it's possible one of the other parties may have called for declaration. But as it stands, there's no declaration on DTA. On rates and monetary bill, there's a declaration. So, Tandy, you're there, right? And on the other bill, we're having a brief debate. Now, as I understand it, if all goes well, you see, this is where I don't know, and Mr. Mania himself may not know. I'm not sure how the House is going to respond to the appointment of the intelligence office. Now, on that matter, I don't know how long it will take, but if all goes according to plan, are you people going to oppose it, or is there going to be a debate there? Right, so that means we're going to be out of there very soon then. If I'm correct, we should be ready at 3:15 at the latest. Where are we meeting? It's after G26, is it? Alan's G26, or here? All right, so high heels or not, I think it's reasonable to say that, that you can get from the National Assembly. Now, one option you can think about, Alan, is to have like a trolley system, right, which you can charge for as a service. Those who battle with their heels, never mind that they have a choice not to wear them, you can push them in a trolley and bring them here. But can I suggest that people look at the DA proposals, I've been through them myself, and so on, to facilitate the process. We've got the whole of tomorrow as well. But do you want to sit here endlessly? Oh, I should clarify. Alan's come back to say it's 156 hours, right, Alan? That we have dealt with this bill in committee. But if you add the National Treasury and you add the study tour, it is over $200, because I asked him, Mr. Monnet, Saturday, and that's what he gave me. So we'll give you all of that in the report to Parliament. But in short, the aim would be to be here within 10 minutes of the sitting of the House in respect of our bill, then we exit, right? Then we come here. Then we continue tomorrow till whatever time we want.
Yes. When does the vote come run for 5 minutes to the chamber?
As I understand it, there will be no vote. Have you seen the program?
Yes.
There's no vote. Other stuff is more like motions and so on. Yeah, what is wrong with G26, Alan?
It's booked up by...
Sorry?
It's booked up by another committee.
Yeah, can you speak into the mic? How long have you been here, my friend?
It's booked out by another committee.
Yeah, what committee?
I don't
what
know.
What parliamentary it's committee or one of the admin committees?
I think
committees?
It's ANC HR.
No. We must be very clear. If it's a portfolio committee, they have precedence over any party structure. If it's a portfolio committee, they have precedence, Ellen, how long you've been here, over some admin that's looking at the lunch they're organizing and all that. Right. And there's no debate about that. Ellen? Just do it. You have a problem? Phone me. I'll speak to Ban Ki-moon's successor if I have to. Judge, do you agree with us? The judge. Yeah. Just tell him that Judge Dennis Davis, no less. And he'll hold them before his judge, what? Judge for yourself program. Yeah. So that's it. There's only to bring in ex-Ban Ki-moon's successor, I'm regret, I don't know his name, or Kosazana Dlamini Zuma. Judge Dennis Davis is more powerful. He's a judge. Right. Having said that, I want to alert members, and I hope you're listening, Mr. Momania. FAWU went on a strike, a protest yesterday. And there are members in the ANC know-how who are also nervous about the sugar tax bill. We know you have the regulatory power, but I think it will be amiss of this committee not to at least have a hearing on the sugar tax thing, which you yourself have wanted anyway, Mr. Momanya. Right. Yeah. So what I'm saying, no. Look here, you can't bring us endless bills and then expect us to do all of this. So what I'm suggesting is when we meet on the 24th, I hope people are listening, 24th, we're going to have the sugar tax bill. Then we're going to go to, Pinky, you'll have to hold the members there. We're going to go to the bait bridge thing following Monday and Tuesday. 24th of January, it's that. 25th is the IRBA rotation of auditors hearing. The following week, it'll be going to Polokwane. We're going to leave on the Monday. We're back on the Tuesday evening. On the Wednesday onwards, we start with the Money Bills Act. Joan herself says that she's very keen on this financial sector regulation conference hearing, but that'd be a big thing. So I think we do that in March. So I'm already preparing the program. Hopefully, between Alan, Tavo, and me, we'll send you a draft by Thursday afternoon, Friday morning. Right. Having said that, is there anything else on program issues for now? Right. So we meet here 10 minutes after our debate ends. Thank you very much.
Yeah.